Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the Guaranteed Journalism edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week of Web Wisdom, are we the only humans? The case for the guaranteed income, the history of everything, and the importance of journalism. Let's begin episode 361.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. My apologies, but my voice is still not healed enough to make it through an entire show. So the expected 2016 Best of Edition will happen next week. But for this week, here's some knowledge thanks to the web. Let us start off with a bit from ThinkFact asking the question, are we the only humans left standing? Let's listen and learn.
Humans seem to be diverse in terms of the phenotypes we can exhibit. Phenotypes being the observable traits that are a result of our genetics and to a lesser extent, our environment. And yes, though there are differences between people alive today, they constitute much less separation than what we have historically come to believe. What we call human in English initially referred to existing people, a term that would go on to also describe our morality and intelligence. But what we now call human is being challenged with scientific facts along with the semantics that change the way we think. So are we the people of today the only humans? Well, let's find out. First off, I want to quickly discuss the construct of race. Race is a folk taxonomy that uses culture, skin color, language, and geography to place us into separate groups. Saying race doesn't exist is not ignoring the obvious differences between us. It's acknowledging that these differences don't constitute to as much differentiation as we have historically thought it did. So for example, let's say you have a native Korean and a native Nigerian. Because genetic information that is passed down from generation to generation is quite sporadic but at the same time quite limited, you are very likely to find a Korean and a Nigerian that have more in common genetically with each other than they would with other individuals from their respective country. And the same can be said for any groups of humans, whether it be Indians and Native Americans or Australian Aboriginals and Italians. Even though we tend to categorize people based off appearance often leads us to formulate false conclusions in terms of which humans have more genetic similarities, simply because when all their genetic material is taken into context, it says otherwise. I will be discussing this stuff in a future video, but I bring it up because it's important to note that this has actually led individuals to believe that the different looking people of today are actually subspecies of one species. Brown people, white people, black people, all supposedly being a subspecies of Homo sapiens. And I want to make it very, very clear, that is completely incorrect, both in terms of science and in terms of semantics. But all of us as a whole are a subspecies. You, no matter what your background is, and I are both anatomically modern humans. This is a phrase to describe our specific subspecies, specifically known as Homo sapien sapien, which basically means wise, wise man. Yep, this extension has become more and more apparent as we keep discovering individuals that are not anatomically modern humans, but nonetheless the same species as us. We understand that they are the same species as us due to their capabilities meeting the definition. For we have the capability to interbreed and exchange genetic material, producing offspring that are themselves fertile. And this is important to know, for just because two different species can produce offspring with each other does not necessarily mean both of those animals are subspecies of the same species. If their offspring cannot be fertile with each other, it's a dead end. Anatomically modern humans, on the other hand, were capable of having fertile offspring with Homo halobergensis, the last scientifically classified separate organism that we evolved from. We could also produce fertile offspring with Neanderthals and Denisovans, both of which evolved from Homo halobergensis just like us. And lastly, this list also includes our closest non-Homo sapien sapien relative, Homo sapien adaltu. Homo sapien adaltu, unsurprisingly, is the one that scientists feel the most comfortable with listing as a subspecies of Homo sapien along with us. Evidence is further showing that Neanderthals and Denisovans are also subspecies of Homo sapiens along with us. Genetic and physical evidence is starting to make scientists rethink how encompassing our species is, simply due to the scientific terminology specifying that they are just as human as we are. So not only are these organisms capable of breeding with our specific subspecies, but in terms of semantics, they are the same exact species as you and I. But this has been difficult to finalize simply based off of terminology, not capability. There have even been multiple specimens found that are a mix of anatomically modern humans and Neanderthals, modern humans with archaic features that are associated with Neanderthals. And if anything, race, how we perceive it today, would actually be technically more accurate at this level of context, but I would still advise against using it. And in all reality, this type of stuff makes me think of the Lord of the Rings, with humans and dwarves and elves, where there was occasionally different types of humanoids going on to have families with each other, essentially making mixed children. And for most of human history, the kind of world we lived in was actually very much like that, except with no magic, which of course is a shame, but you know. Even today, by means of genetic sequencing, we've been able to determine that all modern humans outside of sub-Saharan Africa can have upwards to 5% of their DNA originating from Neanderthals or Denisovans. And the very fact that this DNA exists within a mass majority of human populations today further shows us that our ancestors did interbreed, and they were capable of having fertile offspring that could pass on these genes over and over again. And one of the problems that makes this unnecessarily controversial is some people just don't like the idea of their ancestors having interbred with these other organisms, like Neanderthals, even though they perfectly meet the requirements for them to be considered the same species as us. And some people just don't like hearing that, and part of the reason is because we have presented them as being very dumb and slow and just unmoral. It would be an insult to assume they have any genetic relationship with us due to inbreeding. All of us humans are pure, simply 100% Homo sapiens sapiens. But the context paints a much more accurate picture, and why we just shouldn't think that. I mean, Neanderthals had many behaviors we associate with humans today. They buried their dead and sometimes even buried them with flowers. They even cared for the sick and injured. They would talk to one another. They had social complex cultures just like we do today. They even played instruments, had art and symbolism. These were beings who share some of the most fundamental things that we associate with being human, even from a philosophical point of view. Our and their genetics and behavior goes to show how human they truly are. I mean, just look at these pictures of facial reconstructions of Neanderthal skulls. These are people who could actually probably get away in our modern society living with us without many people thinking twice about what they were. So yes, me being human, with the majority of my ancestry being European in origin, as well as having Native American ancestry, I also have Neanderthal ancestry. Heck, I even have a brow arch, but that doesn't make me stupid. Nor does it necessarily mean it comes from Neanderthals, but hey, keeps the sun out of my eyes, and I consider that an advantage. It also emphasized my eyebrows, so you know, ladies. And going beyond this, some people even say the first humans, from a behavioral point of view, were actually the organisms known as Homo erectus. Because many of the behaviors that we associate with humans today can be first seen with them. So are we anatomically modern humans, Homo sapiens sapien, the only humans? Well, from a survival point of view, yes. But from a genetic point of view, from our subspecies, Absolutely not. And from a species point of view, also including many other organisms within our genus, it looks like from a behavioral point of view, they are human too. And the more and more we discover, the more and more this becomes apparent. And this brings up my last and one of my most important points. We try to group understandings with our language, but sometimes our old words do not correlate with our new understandings. And it's gotta be up to us to fix that. This is because words shape how we perceive the world, how we think about things. And yes, some people don't like this type of change because it will force them to reevaluate their ideologies. But if words with old understandings are not fixed to meet the standards of our new understandings, we will only ever have misunderstandings. Definitions are not meant to shape the truth. The truth is meant to shape our definitions. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the video. My question for you guys is, what are your thoughts about the term human being more inclusive?
Next, Neil deGrasse Tyson and a brief history of everything via metaphysics. Let's listen and learn.
The world has persisted many a long year, having once been set going in the appropriate motions. From these, everything else follows. Lucretius. In the beginning, about 13.7 billion years ago, all the space and all the matter and all the energy of the known universe was contained in a volume less than 1/1,000,000,000th the size of the point of a pin. Conditions were so hot, the basic forces of nature that collectively described the universe were unified. For reasons unknown, this sub-pinpoint-sized cosmos began to expand. When the universe was a piping hot 10 to the 30th degrees and a youthful 10 to the minus 43 seconds old, before which all of our theories of matter and space break down and have no meaning. Black holes spontaneously formed, disappeared, and formed again out of the energy contained within the unified field. Under these extreme conditions, in what is admittedly speculative physics, the structure of space and time became severely curved as it gurgled into a spongy, foam-like form. During this epoch, phenomena described by Einstein's general theory of relativity, the modern theory of gravity, and quantum mechanics, the description of matter in its smallest scales, were indistinguishable from one another. As the universe continued to expand and cool, gravity split from the other forces. Quickly thereafter, the strong nuclear force and the electroweak force split from each other, which was accompanied by an enormous release of stored energy that induced a rapid 30 power of 10 increase in the size of the universe. The rapid expansion of the universe, known as the epoch of inflation, stretched and smoothed out the cosmic distribution of matter and energy so that any regional variation in density became less than one part in 100,000. Continuing onward with what is now laboratory-confirmed physics, the universe was hot enough for photons to spontaneously convert their energy into matter-antimatter particle pairs, which immediately thereafter annihilated each other, returning their energy back to the photons. For reasons unknown, this symmetry between matter and antimatter had been broken, which led to a slight excess of matter over antimatter. For every billion antimatter particles, a billion plus one matter particles were born. This asymmetry was small, but really, really important for the future evolution of the universe. As the universe continued to cool, the electroweak force split into the electromagnetic force and the weak nuclear force, completing the four distinct and familiar forces of nature. While the energy of the photon bath continued to drop, pairs of matter-antimatter particles could no longer be created spontaneously from the available photons. All remaining pairs of matter-antimatter particles swiftly annihilated, leaving behind a universe with one particle of ordinary matter for every billion photons, and no antimatter. Had this matter over antimatter asymmetry not emerged, the expanding universe would forever be composed of light and nothing else. Not even astrophysicists. Over a roughly 3-minute period, protons and neutrons assembled from the annihilations to become the simplest atomic nuclei. Meanwhile, free-roving electrons thoroughly scattered the photons to and fro, creating an opaque soup of matter and energy. When the universe cooled below a few thousand degrees Kelvin, about the temperature of fireplace embers, the loose electrons moved slowly enough to get snatched from the soup by the roving nuclei to make completed atoms of hydrogen, helium, and lithium, the three lightest elements. The universe is now, for the first time, transparent to visible light, and these free-flying photons are visible today as the cosmic microwave background. Over the first billion years, the universe continued to expand and cool as matter gravitated into these massive concentrations we call galaxies. Between 50 and 100 billion of them formed, each containing hundreds of billions of stars that undergo thermonuclear fusion in their cores. Those stars with more than about 10 times the mass of the Sun achieve sufficient pressure and temperature in their cores to manufacture dozens of elements heavier than hydrogen, including elements that compose the planets and life upon them. These elements would be embarrassingly useless were they to remain locked inside the star. But high-mass stars fortuitously explode, scattering their chemically enriched guts throughout the galaxy. After 7 or 8 billion years of such enrichment, an undistinguished star was born in an undistinguished region of an undistinguished galaxy in an undistinguished part of the universe, the outskirts of the Virgo supercluster. During the formation of this star system, matter condensed and accreted out of the parent cloud of gas while circling the Sun. The gas cloud from which the Sun formed contained a sufficient supply of heavy elements to form a system of planets, thousands of asteroids, and billions of comets. For several hundred million years, the persistent impacts of high-velocity comets and other leftover debris rendered molten the surfaces of the rocky planets, preventing the formation of complex molecules. As less and less accretable matter remained in the solar system, the planet's surfaces began to cool. The one we call Earth formed in a zone around the Sun where oceans remain largely liquid in form. Had Earth been much closer to the Sun, the oceans would have vaporized. Had Earth been much farther, the oceans would have frozen. In either case, life as we know it would not have evolved. Within the chemically rich liquid oceans, by a mechanism unknown, there emerged simple anaerobic bacteria that unwittingly transformed Earth's carbon dioxide-rich atmosphere into one with sufficient oxygen to allow aerobic organisms to emerge and dominate the oceans and land. These same oxygen atoms, normally found in pairs, O2, also combined in threes to form ozone, O3, in the upper atmosphere that protects Earth's surface from most of the Sun's molecule-hostile ultraviolet photons. The remarkable diversity of life on Earth, and we presume elsewhere in the universe, is owed to the cosmic abundance of carbon and the countless number of molecules, simple and complex, made from it. How can you argue when there are more varieties of carbon-based molecules than all other molecules combined? But life is fragile. Earth's encounters with large, leftover meteors, a formerly common event, wreak intermittent havoc upon the ecosystem. A mere 65 million years ago, less than 2% of Earth's past, a 10 trillion ton asteroid hit what is now the Yucatan Peninsula and obliterated over 70% of Earth's species of flora and fauna, including dinosaurs, the dominant land animals. This ecological tragedy pried open an opportunity for small surviving mammals to fill freshly vacant niches. One big-brained branch of these mammals, that which we call primates, evolved a genus and a species, Homo sapiens, to a level of intelligence that enabled them to invent methods and tools of science, to invent astrophysics, and to deduce the origin and evolution of the universe. Yes, the universe had a beginning. Yes, the universe continues to evolve. And yes, every one of our body's atoms is traceable to the Big Bang and to the thermonuclear furnace within high-mass stars. We are not simply in the universe, we are part of it. We are born from it. One might even say we've been empowered by the universe to figure itself out. And we've only just begun.
We'll return after this break.
Thousands of opinions are at our fingertips. But are all opinions informed? Does your information have a source? Is your social feed based on fact? Only facts can uncover the truth. Professional journalists are committed to balanced and nonpartisan reporting, to independent commentary. They cut through the spin to give you the information and perspective you need. Journalism is essential to democracy. A watchdog over the powerful, an independent voice. Journalism is more important than ever.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 FM CITR Vancouver, your single species of human skeptical radio broadcast. And we're back. Next, we have a RSA, or Royal Society of the Encouragement of Arts, Manufacturing, Commerce. and the case for the guaranteed income. Let's listen and learn.
Basic income is a very simple and very powerful form of welfare. Essentially, the RSA's model of basic income, and there are many others, involves giving every adult around £3,700 per year, unconditionally, and with up to £4,200 for each child. These are 2012 prices. A family of three with a child under the age of five would receive in the region of £11,000 per year. Universal payment, unconditional. This replaces all tax credits, child benefits and personal tax allowances. When combined with the proposed national living wage, our system aims to help families on low pay at least match their entitlements under universal credit. The overall cost of our system would be somewhere in the region of 1% of GDP in addition to the current system of taxes and benefits. And we argue this is affordable. The state will be about 36% of GDP by 2020 under the current government's plans. 37% is hardly scary. Expansion of tax credits in the 2000s cost in excess of 1% of GDP. And discretionary changes made to personal allowances, corporation taxes, inheritance tax and fuel duty by the current Chancellor are well in excess of 1% of GDP, and that's despite austerity. The single-tier pension, which is coming in, again, is of a similar sort of quantum. The increase in funding for the NHS is even greater than this 1%. So the change is not unprecedented by any means. We must keep coming back to the question of what types of lives we want our welfare system to support. And this is where basic income becomes really powerful. Essentially, it is a bedrock on which to develop your future. It supports work, as all individual pays on each extra pound they earn is taxed on national insurance, which is 32% on current rate. There's no means-tested taper, and that can remove up to 80% of additional income, as in the current system. So the incentives to work are strong, not only at lower levels of earning, but across the piece. You don't hit the wall. However, it also supports those who want to learn to improve their prospects. The choices are the individuals and do not have to be justified to an intrusive state bureaucracy. And that bureaucracy, by the way, costs us £5-6 billion a year. Basic income also provides some support for those who wish to set up a business or care for others. In other words, it is a basic building block of security on which to develop your ideas and potential. That's its power. Importantly, basic income is the system that is adapted to the type of economy and society we seem likely to see developing over the next few decades. In a recent speech to the TUC, the Bank of England's chief economist, Andrew Haldane, outlined the risks facing today's workforce. A number of deep trends are beginning to emerge. The very wealthiest are capturing an outsized share of income. Pay and productivity are separated to the detriment of the median worker, and underemployment is becoming endemic. It is difficult to separate the cyclical from the structural, but what we may be seeing, in part, is the impact of new technologies on workers. From the current vantage point, there can be little certainty about the final impacts of these changes. Haldane, using a model developed by Carl Frey and Michael Osborne at the University of Oxford, forecasts that 35% of workers have a high chance of their work becoming automated, and 28% face a medium chance. There's been some sort of sensationalist predictions of tech-induced unemployment on the back of this type of data. The more likely scenario does seem to be that there will be significant underemployment. Fears about automation and work are not new. And we know from history that the job market is dynamic. There is no lump of labour. But new types of work are emerging all the time at both the top and bottom end of the skills range. Many jobs in the middle are disappearing. We can be sure that large numbers will have to adapt to technological change. Indeed, a recent report from the McKinsey Institute concludes, clearly, organisations and government will need new ways of mitigating the human costs, including job losses and economic inequality, associated with the dislocation that takes place as companies separate activities that can be automated from the individuals who currently perform them. If median and low-pay workers continue to suffer, they need a better platform. Basic income is the foundation of that platform, enabling people to retrain, set up a business, and manage unforeseen changes in their working lives. It doesn't disincentivize work, and they don't have to answer for the changes that they're making to any state bureaucracy. At some point, we're going to have to address the lives we want to lead question in the context of the current welfare state, and this welfare state commands neither support nor is it particularly effective. By way of comparison, where we have a real-world example of a basic income system in Alaska, it inspires very widespread support to the extent that the Alaskan system, which pays a basic income to all its citizens, is called the third rail of Alaskan politics. If you touch it, you fry. It's much like the NHS in the British context. So why would the RSA propose such a significant break with the current welfare system? The answer is simple. If people are to pursue creative lives that make a contribution, basic income is peerless. A context of failing welfare, social and technological change make the imperative for change even stronger. It's not the whole answer, but it's the beginning of one. Basic income is a simple system that provides a basic platform on which people can pursue their lives. It underpins freedom and it underpins creativity. And free and creative lives are what we should aim to build our welfare around. We hope you'll join the cause.
Firstly, I want to say that it might seem strange that one of the main forces historically for a basic income has been on the right. Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman, libertarian political economists, both were major proponents of a basic income style system. Perhaps one of the reasons why we're able to reconcile this is that we call it a negative income tax. Some people try and say that a negative income tax and basic income aren't a similar system, and I can see why they'd say that. I think there's important rhetorical differences between them. But essentially, they're the same thing. With a negative income tax, you withdraw the money that you're giving. With a basic income, you give money in a bulk and withdraw it through taxes. Essentially, those are two ways of achieving the same distributional outcome, although there might be reasons for and against them. So my second point is a negative income tax is actually more feasible, I think, in our current system. It can bring more people over to its side. There's no need to effectively change the tax system. All you need to do is set up the benefit and withdraw it as people rise up the income scale. My third point is that essentially we have a trilemma here, a problem which you probably can't see, but we can go, you won't be able to read the label certainly, but it's like a triangle. Imagine up here we have a shallow withdrawal rate. So we proposed a withdrawal rate of 32%, or the RSA have in their paper. So that's a shallow withdrawal rate. We can get that, and we can get generosity, but that means it's very expensive. And so essentially we have these three things we're looking for. We want a shallow withdrawal rate that doesn't discourage work. We want generosity so that people who are badly off have the incomes they need to live a good life, and we don't want it to cost too much. We can't achieve all three. We have to choose two to achieve, and that's a difficult question. What we need to be realistic about is that most people will not be any better off under this system, but what the real importance of it is to change the way welfare is paid out, the incentives people have to do different things, and the cost of running the system, which brings me on to my fourth point, which is that you can bring the right on side with this issue if you stress the certain benefits you get out of it. So one of those is that to bring the right on side, you need to propose scrapping a lot of benefits to get there. The RSA's proposal scraps quite a few. I would say that you could go a lot further. People tend to think that you should treat the housing system as a different problem to the welfare system. And to some extent that's true, and I think that's a fair thing to do. And they've done this here, and I think there's a reasonable proposal. But it would be better to roll housing benefit in to a higher basic income. We need people to go where opportunities are. And the current housing benefit system and the rental system, that albeit are better than the current system, but it would still be tied to local areas, giving you an incentive to stay where rents are higher. I think that a benefit system should give you the same amount of money, but encouraging you to go where living costs are lower to make the best of that money. And I think that's one of the kinds of things that could bring more people on side if we want to make a political compromise. Which brings me on to my fifth point, which is, why do people like me, liberal market type people, favour something like a basic income or negative income tax? And so one of these is distortions like location. I think that a common narrative is that people find that they're worried about having to reapply or losing their benefits if they move to find work or to find just a better life, the creative life that was being talked about. And a negative income tax or a basic income completely loosens that bond and allows you've got your guaranteed income wherever you go. You don't need to reapply. You know how much it will be. There's no uncertainty. The withdrawal is steady. Secondly, it's freer. you have more choice over how you spend your money and how you get your money. You don't have to apply for various different benefits. And the problem with universal credit is, though you don't necessarily need to apply at all stages and it makes it easier for you and streamlines the process, essentially you haven't really changed anything. You're still trying to make everyone slightly better off under the rules of the previous system. The basic income and negative income tax will be less certain about making everyone as well off as they were before. Finally, there's this point that was very well made before, which is that in the modern world, with technological changes and globalization, this steady, well-paid work, just for technical factors, probably doesn't exist. Now, people can still do lots of valuable things, but they might never have the skills that allow them to earn an income which is enough, by modern standards, gives them a decent living. Now, it's still worthwhile for them to work, but we should top that income up to make sure they can live the lives that we deem acceptable today.
Well, it's already a fascinating debate, and we've got two more people to hear from. So we're going next to the economic commentator, analyst Francis Coppola.
I started writing about basic income about 3 years ago, and I was looking at the future of work, and I was writing about the way in which work in our society is changing, the way in which it's becoming more flexible, what we do is changing, how we do it is changing, and looking at the effects of technology. And the way in which we have historically failed to value certain types of work, there are certain types of work that historically have not been paid, in the future they may have to be paid, how we value those. And this melting pot at the moment, which reminded me hugely of the Industrial Revolution, actually, the previous one, which incidentally was the last time that the United Kingdom experimented with something approaching a basic income. And then got scared and abolished it in favour of workhouses. I think we are pretty much agreed that that wasn't exactly a constructive step. I am concerned that some of the rhetoric I hear at the moment in terms of harshness and conditionality and the moral imperative to work seems to take us back in that direction again, and I don't think it's a road down which we should be going. So I welcome this as an alternative. As to say, let's see if we can find something that actually makes the best use we can of what we might term human capital, because it's not just the individuals concerned who are the richer in their personal lives if they're able to do work that makes the best use of their talents and abilities. Actually, we as a society are way richer, not just in financial terms but also socially, if people generally are doing work that is to the best of their abilities. And what concerns me hugely about the approach to welfare that we take at the moment is that it basically says any job will do. Well, I'm sorry, any job won't do. And when we have a welfare system that forces people to take any job, regardless of whether it suits their skills and abilities and regardless of whether it gives them any path at all out of the very low income that they are in, and any ability to make better use of their innate abilities or to learn or to develop those, then we are basically sacrificing the long term for the short term. We are dooming ourselves to a low pay, a low productivity, and really quite stagnant economy, and I don't think that's where we should be. So one of the things that neither Anthony nor Ben brought out was what I would term, what you might call a multiplier effect, which is immensely difficult to cost. Whenever we're talking about basic income, everybody always says, oh, it'll be far too expensive. A lot of the models that are produced basically try and say, oh, well, it isn't going to be any more expensive than the current system. You know, RSA has gone a little bit further and saying, well, it is a bit more expensive, but that's worth having. At a pilot level, I think we do have to start there because of people's huge fears about cost at the moment. But if this works as I think it might, if it enables people to do more productive work, and after all, one of the big issues we have in our economy at the moment is productivity, then actually the long-term effect should be that we are very much better off, and the expense of this becomes lost in the improvements in productivity, in wages, and in national income. And that's something that, as I said, immensely hard to cost, but just from a theoretical point of view, I think at least should be borne in mind that if people, we are able to make better use of our human capital as a society through taking a longer term view and supporting people while they train, while they develop their skills, while they look for the right job, not just any job, then not only they, but the whole of society will be the richer for it.
Well, Anthony's done a great job puffing up a great big new idea, and heaven knows we need one, because the adequacy of the benefit system is fast drifting back to where it was in 1997, or I should say the inadequacy of the benefit system and the poverty there. And in some of the main benefits, one thinks of unemployment, JSA, Job Seekers Allowance, is actually going to be lower soon in real terms than it was in 1997, because we're having these years of freezes. And there was a sense in the mid-1990s that Britain was scarred and disfigured by poverty, and as Social Security is unwound, I think it's going to be similarly disfigured again. And so I think we need to look at any big ideas that can do something about putting this on a firmer footing of legitimacy than it's had during these last few Benefit Street years. Some questions on the technicalities. I'm not going to get into them here. I'm just going to sort of register them. When the Social Security system that you want to make nice and simple so everyone can understand it and they can understand where they stand in relation to it, always gets a bit snared on things in real life. One thing that's carved out of the system Anthony proposes are some of the disability benefits. I think that's all right. I think that where people are very sick, you could have a separate payment that compensates them for that, and that could just sit on the sidelines. The trickier one is going to be housing, as it has been since some Beveridge. Anthony's got some ideas about how you'd address it by localising housing policy, and perhaps then only giving an extra top-up to people who rent, and then you'd withdraw it as their income rises. My own view is that I think you're going to need extra subsidy in London, which then probably will need to be clawed back more quickly than real advocates of a citizen's income would like. I thought that it was great that the report started with this example of someone who is, I think, a trainee nurse who's then told by the job centre, no, you've got to pack that in and go and work at Poundland or whatever it is. It's the kind of horror story that we've all heard either through the media or just through talking to people who are caught in the snare of the benefit system. One thing the report didn't do, but I thought it usefully could do maybe in terms of putting this thing, giving this thing a kind of academic response, respectability, is using some of the language of modern microeconomics about asymmetric information. Things going wrong because one person knows more about something, normally their own affairs, than the other side does. Now, we're familiar now with terms like moral hazard when someone's selling you a financial product that's a bit dodgy, but I think that there are those sorts of issues at play here. If someone's giving you money and then they're taking it off you again because they've decided you're not poor enough, you have got a moral hazard to stay poor. Likewise, if you know that your training is going to be very useful and you can see that it's going to put you on a more secure financial footing for the future, then you're probably in a much better position to make a judgment on whether that's a worthwhile investment in your future than a bureaucrat is at the Job Centre Plus. And so I think actually this goes back to some of these kind of points about why the right might be interested in this, is actually there's some inefficiencies here that are inescapably related to the fact that the citizen knows more about their circumstances than the bureaucrat does, and so it's maybe better to put the citizen in charge. Finally, let's just talk a little bit about the politics, which are, you know, going to be bloody difficult in the UK. They're going to be difficult because 1% of GDP is doable in some senses. Yes, 1%, more than 1% of GDP has been found for the NHS and for tax credits in the recent past. However, lots of things are being squeezed and lots of things are in the queue for wanting the 1% of GDP if and when it becomes available. Yes, pilot first would be a very good idea. Maybe an even better idea to start off in Norway or somewhere where you've got a sovereign wealth fund to play with. But still, I'm enthusiastic about this. I did a book earlier in the year about why, despite the Great Recession, public support for the welfare state appears to have fallen away at just the time when so many people needed it. And I concluded that that was to do with a sort of two-thirds, one-thirds division of them and us division in the way that the welfare state gets talked about. Partly this is about tabloid myths and the idea that there's people who just lie about waiting for the next on the sofa, waiting for the next cheque to come through. And I realise this is what you're up against. There's a bit of that, but there's also a bit of the reality, which is that the old arguments we used to make about risk pooling and risk sharing possibly have less bite than they used to in a more equal society. The sad truth is that there's lots of graduates living in the right parts of town who are not very likely to be made unemployed and are therefore not as interested as they would have been in years gone by in a job seekers allowance type system. So I really do think the politics, if you want to do anything about the poor, do point to finding a new basis for footing the system on. I mean, I start out pragmatic. I don't mind if you do that through social insurance on the one hand, or on the other hand, that you try and go down the rights-based, entitlement-based, citizens' income type route. And I think that the very compelling way in which this report is written makes me think that there might be more mileage in the citizens' income type route than I'd been thinking before, particularly because, and I'll finish in this with this, I think you can see it playing straight in to the way that Ian Duncan Smith has caricatured a kind of sprawling monster of a welfare system that gets people stuck in its craw kind of thing. There will come a point where he's been in charge for sufficiently long and so many people are poor and we've moved from means testing to savagely mean testing, and actually all the problems we started out with at the beginning have only got worse, and yet there'll still be this idea of a monstrous system that needs taking on, and this is sufficiently different that I think it might just be able to cut through.
We'll return after this break.
Nothing goes together better than live music and a beer. Or two. Or five. Wait a minute. An estimated 886,000 Canadians age 15 and older abused or were dependent on alcohol in 2012. 1 in 7 Canadians aged 15 years and older experience verbal, emotional, and physical abuse as a result of another person's drinking. Make sure a fun night out doesn't ruin everyone else's, or your own. If you see yourself or someone you know slightly off-key, help everyone out and step in. After all, you want to be able to remember the show tomorrow morning.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker, your guaranteed source of knowledge and skepticism. And we're back. And lastly, we end with a clip from John Oliver and Last Week Tonight about the importance of and problem with journalism, an issue made all the more front and center with the election of Donald Trump and his recent, quote, press conference. Let's listen and learn.
Journalists, the heroes that we root for in movies like All the President's Men, The Great Muppet Caper, and most recently, Spotlight.
We gotta nail these scumbags. We gotta show people that nobody can get away with this. Not a priest or a cardinal or a freaking pope.
Now remember, Spotlight actually won Best Picture at the Oscars this year, meaning newspapers finally received the recognition that we normally reserve for subjects of such importance as the incredible bravery of real-life Hollywood filmmakers, the incredible bravery of fictional Hollywood filmmakers, and the incredible bravery of wanting to f*** your daughter's friends. But one of the things that made Spotlight so powerful is the knowledge that the newspaper industry today is in big trouble. Papers have been closing and downsizing for years, and that affects all of us. Even if you only get your news from Facebook, Google, Twitter, or Arianna Huffington's Block Quote Junction and Book Excerpt Clearinghouse, those places are often just repackaging the work of newspapers, and it is not just websites. Watch how often TV news ends up citing print sources.
According to the Chicago Tribune.
According to the Detroit Free Press.
According to the San Francisco Chronicle.
According to the Times-Picayune.
The Boston Globe.
The Orlando Sentinel.
The Philadelphia Inquirer.
The Pittsburgh Tribune Review.
The Detroit News.
And the Houston Chronicle reports.
The Los Angeles Times reports.
The Oklahoman reports.
The Hartford Current reports.
The Salt Lake Tribune reports.
It's pretty obvious, without newspapers around to cite, TV news would just be Wolf Blitzer endlessly batting a ball of yarn around. And it is not just news outlets. Stupid shows like ours lean heavily on local papers. In fact, whenever this show is mistakenly called journalism, it is a slap in the face to the actual journalists whose work we rely on. I'll give you just one example. 2 years ago, we ran a piece on state lotteries, and a not insignificant portion of it was built on the work of Harry Estev, a reporter at The Oregonian. Here is a clip we used of him talking about this series on camera. Here I am quoting one of his Oregonian stories directly, and here I am doing it again. You probably didn't notice it at the time because you were too fixated on my bold choice of shiny grey tie with checkered dress shirt. The tie says Mafia Funeral, the shirt says High School Debate Tournament, and the face says, I am not confident enough to carry this lock off. But the point is, we used a lot of Harry Estev's work in that piece, and we try to add new information to our stories. Our researchers work incredibly hard. But the media is a food chain which would fall apart without local newspapers. And the problem is, print ads are less popular with advertisers than they used to be, and online ads produce much less revenue. I'll show you. Between 2004 and 2014, newspapers gained $2 billion in online ad revenue. Unfortunately, in that same period, they lost $30 billion in print revenue. So that's like finding a lucky penny on the sidewalk on the same day your bank account is drained by a 16-year-old Belgian hacker. And this has led to cutbacks in newsrooms. Again, look at The Oregonian. It used to be a big moneymaker. In fact, in 1993, their editor talked about how proud he was of its record of success.
I've been at that paper more than 40 years, and every year I've been there, I've seen our staff increase. I've seen our salaries increase. Not a year has gone by that an employee at the Oregonian, full-time employee, has not been a beneficiary of a raise.
Now, that level of confidence is almost tempting fate. He's like a citizen of Pompeii saying, what I love about this city is how volcano-proof it is. Not a year goes by without us not having to have our horrified reactions captured in ash forever. Unfortunately, the Oregonian's circulation has since dropped, and in 2013, just as Harry Estev was working on his lottery series, their parent company, Advanced Publications, dropped a bombshell.
This picture, tweeted out from inside the Oregonian, shows staffers listening as editor Peter Badia broke the news some had feared. The paper will split in two, stop seven-day-a-week home delivery, and lay off some employees.
This is a strategic move to really focus everybody on what that digital future is and what our digital products and services can be.
It's true, they became a digital-first company. And digital-first sounds like a high school euphemism for seductively sucking on a finger. I put my finger in his mouth, we totally got to digital-first. It was like, ooh, but it was also like, hot. And that meant big changes. A local weekly, the Willamette Week, got their hands on a PowerPoint presentation for the Oregonian staff, outlining the fact reporters would be expected to meet a quota of 3 blog posts a day, and on any post of substance, they would have to post the first comment. And what better way to win the trust of your readers than posting first underneath your own article? Those rules were widely criticised and have since been relaxed. But extra digital demands being placed on journalists is now common throughout the industry. Just listen to Washington Post editor Marty Baron, who you might remember as the guy Liev Schreiber played in Spotlight. He describes his concerns about the average workload required of journalists.
They have to do their traditional reporting, they have to participate in social media, they have to produce a wire service that's available 24 hours a day, they have to be responsible for video, you name it, they're involved in it. It's a lot to ask.
That's true. And if journalists are constantly required to write, edit, shoot videos and tweet, mistakes are going to get made. Perhaps that is how the Boston Globe wound up tweeting following a shooting in Tennessee that the FBI had investifarted about 70 leads. Clearly, if they had more time, they would have written hashtag investifarted, because that's how you drive the conversation. Hashtag investifarted. Now, at the Oregonian, those digital demands came just as almost a quarter of the newsroom was laid off. And over time, even more staffers left the paper, including Statehouse reporters, a 2-time Pulitzer winner, and Harry Estev. So his work bolstered our lottery piece, and now the lack of his work has bolstered this journalism piece. So you can't say that we don't use every part of the Harrier Stev. But here is where it gets frightening, because while the Oregonian rebuilt its state house team, other papers have been forced to simply go without. A study of over 200 papers found that between 2003 and 2014, their number of full-time state house reporters declined by 35%. And that's not good, because while there are some great web outlets, some of which do cover local government, there aren't nearly enough to replace what has been lost. Just listen to David Simon, who before creating the TV show The Wire, worked for years at the Baltimore Sun.
The day I run into a Huffington Post reporter at a Baltimore zoning board hearing is the day that I will be confident that we've actually reached some sort of equilibrium. You know, there's no glory in that kind of journalism, but that is the bedrock of what keeps, you know, got the next 10 or 15 years in this country are going to be a halcyon era for state and local political corruption. It is going to be one of the great times to be a corrupt politician. Right? I really envy them. I really do.
He's right, because not having reporters at government meetings is like a teacher leaving her room of seventh graders to supervise themselves. Best case scenario, Brittany gets gum in her hair. Worst case scenario, you no longer have a school. And look, it is clearly smart for newspapers to expand online, but the danger in doing that is the temptation to gravitate toward whatever gets the most clicks, which is why news organizations badly need to have leaders who appreciate that what's popular isn't always what's most important. But that is not always the case. Look at Sam Zell, a billionaire investor and living garden gnome. Nine years ago, he took over the Tribune Company, which owns newspapers like the LA Times, the Orlando Sentinel, and the Chicago Tribune. After acquiring the company, he spoke to the Sentinel's nervous staff outlining his vision. And listen to one particular exchange with a journalist. His last two words are perhaps the most illuminating.
My attitude on journalism is very simple. I want to make enough money so I can afford you. It's really that simple, okay? You need to, in effect, help me by being a journalist that focuses on what our readers want and therefore generates more revenue.
But what readers want are puppy dogs, and I mean, we also need to inform the community.
I'm sorry. I can't, you're giving me the classic, what I would call, journalistic arrogance of deciding that puppies don't count. Hopefully we get to the point where our revenue is so significant that we can do puppies and a rat.
Oh, whoa, whoa. Sam Zell just created an inspiring new motto for the Sentinel's masthead. All the puppy news that's fit to print, and maybe some Iraq news too, if we can afford it, f*** you. Now, the good news is Zell no longer owns the Tribune Company. The bad news is their latest attempt to balance business pressures with journalistic responsibility has not been confidence-inspiring. Just this year, its publishing arm, Tribute Publishing, was rebranded into something much, much stupider.
This is the future of journalism. This is the future of content. It doesn't get much better than that. If you care about media and technology, this is the place to be. TRONC stands for Tribune Online Content.
Yes, TRONC. They have chosen to call themselves TRONC, which sounds like the noise an ejaculating elephant makes. Or more appropriately, the sound of a stack of print newspapers being thrown into a dumpster. And if you are wondering how TRONC's business model will be different, get ready to have your minds TRONC'd.
One of the key ways we're going to harness the power of our journalism is to have a optimization group. This TRONC team will work with all of the local markets to harness the power of our local journalism, feed it into a funnel, and then optimize it so that we reach the biggest global audience possible.
What the f*** did she just say? They're going to feed journalism into a funnel. Oh, we're just going to take content and simply cram it down your throat like you're an abused goose. And the corresponding visuals make even less sense. What is happening here? It looks like a bunch of digital sperm impregnating a TRONC egg. But what seems at first like a banal corporate rebranding speech quickly goes off the rails with their next big idea.
Artificial intelligence is going to allow journalists to do their jobs more efficiently, finding the right photos, the videos, the databases, the things that you would package your stories with. Right now, that's a manual effort. With artificial intelligence, you can create a system that automatically is doing that for you.
Okay. Putting aside the news robots, I would like to take a moment to break down what may be the most meaningless graphic ever created. If you take a look, on the left, there is the phrase reading habits, but once those reading habits undergo X, they become increased consumption. It almost feels like a test, and the first employee to raise their hand and say, that doesn't mean anything, becomes king of the news. And look, it is easy to make fun of Tronk. I could happily do it for another 20 minutes. But the truth is, publishers are desperate. No one seems to have a perfect plan to keep newspapers afloat. One option seems to be to pray you get bought by a billionaire benefactor who could afford to swallow losses. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post in 2013, and since then they've done some spectacular journalism, and the reporters seem pretty happy, despite some of his stupider ideas like, and this is true, a game that would allow a reader who didn't enjoy an article to pay to remove its vowels. Which is just absurd. Taking out all the vowels makes every word sound like the name of an app. I'll give you an example. Turkey is a nation in crisis. Turk is a dating service that helps you f*** long-haul truckers. But there are potential downsides to having a rich owner, especially if there is a concern that they could meddle with the paper's coverage. Just look at what happened to the Las Vegas Review-Journal last year. It was acquired by Sheldon Adelson, the billionaire casino magnate and Republican megadonor. He's a big deal in Vegas, and his businesses are at the center of a lot of stories the Review-Journal covers. But while Adelson and the paper's editors have strongly denied that he interferes with news coverage in any way, the editors have admitted that they put any articles about him or his business through a special review process to make sure that they are fair. Although, listen to an ex-deputy editor describe his experience of that process.
In this review process, things are changed, things are added, things are removed. There's no explanation for why, and there's no appeal. More than once, reporters have asked if they could have their name taken off the story and have been told, no, that's not allowed anymore. There are things that are done because it's known that this is the way Sheldon Adelson wants it to read. And it can be something very minor or it can be something very, very big.
Now, if that's true, that is very compromising. There could not be a worse owner of a paper in Vegas than Sheldon Adelson, with the possible exception of Cirque du Soleil. Because they wouldn't even give you a newspaper. You just have a fistful of glitter thrown in your face by a 90-pound man in a thong. And look, none of this is to say that there aren't people producing great work in local newsrooms right now. Many are, at The Oregonian, at The Review Journal, even at fucking Tronk. But they are doing it despite their current conditions. And the truth is, a big part of the blame for this industry's dire straits is on us and our unwillingness to pay for the work journalists produce. We've just grown accustomed to getting our news for free. And the longer that we get something for free, the less willing we are to pay for it. And I'm talking to you, the person watching this segment on YouTube, using the Wi-Fi from the coffee shop underneath your apartment. You're killing us! But sooner or later, we are either going to have to pay for journalism or we are all going to pay for it. Because if we don't, not only will malfeasance run amok, but the journalism movies of the future are going to look a lot more like this.
In a city built on secrets.
I'm hearing there's corruption in City Hall.
Only a newsroom willing to stop at nothing can uncover the truth.
And might go all the way to the top.
All the way to the top.
They knew. And I think we could prove that they knew.
Yeah, I'm just not sure what kind of clicks we're gonna get on that. Yeah. Anybody else?
I got a thing about a cat that looks like a raccoon. Oh. Or it could be a raccoon that looks like a cat. Wait, I'm not sure.
Now we're talking.
Yeah,
that's great. Let's figure that out.
Okay, great.
Yeah, maybe an online poll.
It's political corruption in Boston.
We'll come back to that if we have time, but...
I like the rat cat.
Oh, rat cat, that's great.
Rat.
Let's blow the roof off that.
It's the movie critics are hailing as genuinely deflating and depressingly accurate. The Oregonian raves. Ugh, who needs a drink? Four reporters.
Actually,
I'm taking a buyout.
Three reporters.
Technically, I'm not a reporter. I'm the director of social media strategies, but I consider myself an important part of the editor.
Two reporters.
I'm also leaving. I'm being replaced by whatever the f*** this is.
One reporter and some kind of burnt orange X chase the story of a lifetime.
How far does this thing go?
I can't tell you.
Okay, well, are we talking all the way up to the mayor?
I got kids, man. I've already said too much.